Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Interview Review. Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School at Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on diabetes when we come back. You know, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. Surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity, from bank deposits to medical visits, has produced greater efficiency and security for us, all right, but it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. Now, the federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American, according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget, but closer to home, our state and local governments use computers to keep their own files on us. Now, a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems containing 10,799 categories of information about New York residents. Every one of those systems contained between 2 and 10 million records. Now, this information about you is gained from 63 sources, and this information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how government, banking, insurance, and industry, along with business, obtains all of this information about you? What are their sources? How is this stored? How is it retrieved? What do they want it for? What are they going to do with it? Well, knowing how this information about you is gathered, and what information is stored, and what information that you want to keep personal and private, actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, if you'd like more information about privacy and privacy issues, then call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Let me tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and just as private as you want to be, just as personal and private as the chief of police in your hometown. Now, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. All you have to do is call us and ask. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Just send an email request. That's georgegordon.org. Click on the email. Send an email request. Again, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about diabetes. I mentioned last time, diabetes is going to affect 1 in 4 Americans. If you're drawing breath today and you're an American, look around the room, and every fourth person before he dies is going to develop diabetes. Most people don't even know that they've got it. Most. They haven't got a clue. And that's because pre-diabetes has no symptoms. Now, there's some discrepancy as to how many people have pre-diabetes. If you want to know what your glucose level is, just go to your local friendly doctor. Give him a $25 bill and sit down and relax and let him tell you. And he'll say, well, you know, you've got diabetes, you've got pre-diabetes, you've got high glucose or whatever it is. Now, if that's the case, it's time to take action. If it isn't the case, it's up to you to decide for yourself. Do you want to wait until you develop insulin resistance, or do you want to take action ahead of time? And the sooner you take action, the less traumatic it's going to be later. Now, sometimes people say, well, I can't lose weight. I can't do this or that. Okay, listen, no problem. If you can't lose weight and if you can't change your lifestyle, then you have to get diabetes. Now, don't get mad at me. I don't care whether you get diabetes or not. There's no skin off my back. But as a reporter, this is a story that needs to be reported. And the mainstream press reports the story about diabetes, but it's a one-sided story that benefits doctors, the medical establishment, and Big Pharma. It's not there to show you how to avoid it. It's there to show you how to deal with it after you get it. The tack taken by medicine is that, well, if you get it, you get it, and if you don't, you don't. But you never can tell, and there's nothing you can do. That's not true. It's got a cause. Fat and sugar are the cause. Now, you don't have to eliminate all fat, and you don't have to eliminate all sugar, but you're going to have to start cutting down on it because, as I pointed out last time, Americans, if you're just the average Joe Sixpack American, the average teenager, drinking 2 soda pops a day, you're consuming 6,700, that's 6,700 teaspoons of sugar a day, or excuse me, per year, 6,700 a year, and your body can only dispose of 1,100 of those. And it's that excess sugar that is destroying your pancreas, destroying your body organs. Sugar is a drug. It's like overdosing on heroin. The difference is that heroin feels a lot better than sugar. has a better response and less time and kills you quicker than sugar, but you know, both of them are drugs. Now, big business, you know, the Coca-Cola company, PepsiCo, and the rest of these companies, they make a lot of money selling you these products. These products taste very good. If they didn't taste good, you wouldn't eat them. You know, if broccoli tasted as good as Coca-Cola, there would be no diabetes in America. None. But broccoli doesn't taste that good. And I don't know why God made broccoli to taste as bad as it does, but for some reason, he did. And because broccoli and Brussels sprouts and cauliflower taste bad, you don't eat as much of it. And because Coca-Cola tastes as good as it does, you drink more of it. And as a result of that, you consume more sugar. Now, there's a couple other factors. I pointed out to you last time, Leviticus 3, verse 17 says, don't eat any fat. Don't eat any fat. None. Zero. If you're thinking about going to the store and buying a pound of suet and bringing it home, cooking it up, salting it real good, and eating it, don't do that. Now, you know people don't go to the store and buy fat. But you go to the hamburger stand and you buy fat, 30% by law, and that's where you're getting all of your fat. About 37 pounds of it a year comes from that 125 pounds of hamburger that you eat every year, and then there's another jag of it that comes from the rest of the meat. And this is why the vegetarians are telling you to stop eating meat. God never told you to stop eating meat. He called vegetarianism a doctrine of devils. He said, don't eat fat. The vegetarian is unable to distinguish between meat and fat. But then so are the religious people. They can't distinguish between clean and unclean meats or meat and fat either. So let's see in the series of programs if we can determine the difference between lean meat and fat. Eat the lean meat, don't eat the fat. Can we just determine the difference between a clean animal, one that's designed for human food, and one that isn't? You know, pigs are unclean, cows are clean. Can we determine that cows are animals we should eat and pigs are animals we shouldn't eat, and that the fat from the pigs and the fat from the cows we should never eat because it's fat, and we were told not to eat fat? Now, I don't care if you eat fat or not, and I don't care if you follow the biblical admonitions. My job as a reporter is to report facts. So I'm giving you the facts that 3,000 years ago you were told what it is that makes your body work. Now, in reality, you are your brain, your mind. Your body is simply the vehicle that your brain is stored in to carry your brain around, to carry you around it. I mean, you know, you cut off your finger, And you can live without it. Now cut off your head and see how long you can live without your head. Take your appendix out and you can live without your appendix. Take your brain out and throw it out and see how long you're going to live. You know, if you stop and think about it, you are what you are because of your mind. All of the experiences, the memories that you have are located in your brain. And your legs are simply the vehicle that moves your torso around, and your torso is simply the vehicle that nourishes your body and nourishes your brain and makes this whole life process worthwhile. Now, you know, people are very careful about the way they take care of their cars. A whole lot more careful about the way they take care of their cars than they are about the way they take care of their bodies. Now, you go out and you get in your car and the battery's dead and you get kind of let down, don't you? You know, you go to start it and it quits, and then you say, oh, damn, my battery's dead. Well, why didn't you take better care of your battery? Why didn't you put a new battery in earlier? Why don't you have your alternator checked? You know, what's going on here? So I'm pretty cautious. I'm pretty careful about taking care of my car. Take it over to the DX station every now and again. Have old Dean over there look at it, and you know, and Gary, he looks at it and he tunes it up and keeps it in good running order and keeps tires on it, and one thing and another, and puts the right kind of fuel in it and the right kind of oil and so on. And hey, listen, my car, it gives me good service. Now I do the same thing with my body, and I'm not concerned about diabetes. I'm not concerned about dead batteries and blown tires and things like that because I take pretty good care of it. I'm conscious of the problem. So I thought I'd share that with you, that there's some problems with our bodies here that's not being reported in the mainstream press. And diabetes is one of them. And diabetes is just about as prevalent now and has just about the same lifespan problem as does AIDS, which I reported on last night. Now, the fat's a problem. And when you take a look at this fat and what is obesity, what connecting link does it have with diabetes? Throughout the majority of the 20th century, type 2 diabetes was considered to be adult onset or maturity onset diabetes, virtually never occurring in anyone under the age of 40. But between the late 70s and the late 90s, in a 20-year period, that view of type 2 diabetes changed dramatically. During that period, healthcare professionals reported that diagnosis of type 2 diabetes in 30-year-olds, 20-year-olds, teens, and even young children. Now, why is type 2 diabetes by far the most common form of diabetes in America, affecting an estimated 15 million Americans? Is there a causal link between obesity and type 2 diabetes, as implied by the term diabesity? Why is type 2 diabetes occurring in children, teens, and young adults? And what responsible action can we take right now? Now, I mentioned to you last time that the consumption of soda pop doubled over the past 20 years, and the prevalence of type 2 diabetes doubled at the same time. And, you know, kids, you don't have to be a real smart person to figure this out. You don't have to be a genius. And soda pop consumption doubled, diabetes doubled. All right, now, the purpose of this conference is to address these important questions. Hypothesis number one, the obesity hypothesis. Obesity is intimately linked, possibly causally linked to the development of type 2 diabetes. This hypothesized causal connection is the origin of the term diabesity. It's been shown that weight loss can greatly improve the symptoms of the disease and can sometimes drive the disease into remission. The obesity hypothesis asserts that the greater prevalence of obesity in America, including the growing prevalence of obesity in children, teens, and young adults, is a direct cause of the growing prevalence of type 2 diabetes. The hypothesis predicts that type 2 diabetes prevalence will be higher in those populations that have a higher prevalence of obesity. For example, African American, Hispanic, and American Indian populations. And it also predicts that the majority of persons with type 2 diabetes are obese. And although it is consistent with the majority of cases of type 2 diabetes, it fails to explain the known occurrence of type 2 diabetes in individuals who are not obese. All right, so you may be fat. And if you are, you've got a greater risk, a greater chance, a greater proportion of fat people are going to have diabetes or develop diabetes than skinny people, but that doesn't mean the skinny people aren't going to get it. And that's because skinny people eat a lot of sugar and skinny people eat a lot of fat, just like fat people do. And I think you're going to find here that your creator told you plainly, don't eat fat. And he had good reason for telling you that. Now, of course, we want to eat fat because it tastes good. Okay, but just because things taste good don't mean that they're good for you. Well, I just can't give up my Big Macs. Well, okay, then you have to have diabetes. You have to have heart attack and stroke because you cannot give up that which causes the cause and effect relationship. McDonald's is really bummed out because people are down on Big Macs and fast food. And I'm sitting there saying, well, I'm not down on Big Macs and fast food. Every once in a while, I go into Kentucky Fried Chicken and I sit down and I eat Kentucky Fried Chicken. But I notice over at the Kentucky Fried Chicken salad bar that they have coleslaw there. They have vegetables on there. And I eat a piece of chicken, and one piece of chicken, usually white breast meat. And then I eat about three times that much coleslaw and other vegetables. Not that there's something wrong with the meat. It's that most people go in and eat 16 pieces of chicken, and that's it. Children, balanced diet is not 16 pieces of chicken. Balanced diet is not McDonald's. Eating at McDonald's isn't going to kill you. And besides that, McDonald's isn't trying to kill you. McDonald's wants to keep you coming back. If McDonald's would buy 100% ground beef instead of 70% ground beef and 30% ground fat, their product would be okay. It's not the Big Mac that's killing you. It's the fat contained in the Big Mac. That's the problem. If McDonald's would serve cold, raw milk, then it would be a healthful diet. You'd have a healthy piece of meat. If they'd serve it on whole wheat buns instead of white bread, there's no reason why a Big Mac couldn't be healthy. It's not, and it probably never will be. Because when you take all the fat out of the hamburger, you people are going to say, this thing don't taste good. Well, okay, then eat more fat. But you need to understand that if you're going to eat fat, you're going to get fat. And if you get fat and you eat sugar along with it, the sugar and fat is going to cause diabetes. Diabetes is going to be the leading cause of heart attack and stroke. So many people say, well, you shouldn't eat at McDonald's. Well, in today's configuration, that's probably true. And you shouldn't be drinking milk either. Milk is poison. Raw milk is food. Pasteurized milk is poison. Hamburger is food. Hamburger with 30% fat in it is poison. Coca-Cola is probably pretty good stuff. Unfortunately, it's got 9 teaspoons of refined sugar. That's poison. So you can take a good food and put poison in it, and then you got poison. You know, let's take a whole wheat bread and put some arsenic in it. What's that make it? Isn't that poison? Now, you can't put these poisons in the food and then call that food. And that's what our problem is, and that's why we get diabetes. Now, there's a second hypothesis here, the physical inactivity hypothesis. Blair and others have shown that physical fitness is associated with reduced risk of disease, even across a wide range of BMIs. The physical inactivity hypothesis argues that it is not obesity per se that is driving the development of type 2 diabetes. Rather, it is the increasing prevalence of physical inactivity and the consequent lack of fitness that is a primary causal factor for the growing prevalence of type 2 diabetes. The physical inactivity hypothesis predicts that obese but physically active fit individuals face a risk of type 2 diabetes that is similar to that of lean, physically active fit individuals. And yet Blair has new data that suggests that the deleterious effects of obesity on fasting glucose levels is not eliminated by fitness. The hypothesis would also predict that lean but physically inactive, unfit individuals face an elevated risk of type 2 diabetes. Skinny couch potatoes, boys and girls, face the same risk as fat couch potatoes, comparable to that of obese, physically inactive, unfit individuals. This needs to be examined. All right, now I'm going to show you another quick study here. The Amish, and these Amish guys over here, see if I can find them on here. No, come on, Georgie. Well, let me start looking through here. One, two. See, the Amish people eat a lot of fat. And they only have half of the diabetes, as do the rest of the people. Here's report number 7. Let me run through this report for you. People around the Mediterranean have been cooking tomatoes and olive oil for hundreds of years, but not everyone in Europe had such a healthy diet. The question is, in olden times, whether it made a big difference. Well, perhaps not, and the reason it's possible to suggest that is that some people still live the way they did in Northern Europe hundreds of years ago. They're the Amish. If you saw the Peter Weir thriller Witness, you'd recognize the name. There are people living in the United States who have rejected modernity and have refrained fairly isolated genetically from the rest, or remained fairly isolated genetically from the rest of American population. We've got an Amish community up here in Seymour. There's a big group of them in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and a lot of them live in Ohio. And these people have half the prevalence of diabetes, and they have the same rate of obesity as the rest of the population, and they have a higher fat consumption than most of the rest of the population. And the answer is they work hard every day. They work hard. So their physical activity overcomes the fat, the high fat content of their diet. A fellow by the name of Alan Schildner, he said, well, the Amish are an interesting population. They began back in Europe around the time of the late 1500s. They're part of the Anabaptist movement, and in Europe they actually were persecuted a lot because of their religious beliefs. And around the early 1700s, several of them migrated to the United States in search of religious freedom. So the Amish are genetic isolates, and in that there are only a few founders that came over in the early 1700s. They settled in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. They're basically farmers in over 250 years or so. They have increased to a population of over 30,000 in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. Norman Swain asks, well, then, is genetics, or in genetics, is this what they call the founder effect, a small group of people from which expands? I think that's the reason why in Tasmania, in Australia, there's a lot of Huntington's disease, because one person got off the boat with the gene in a small population, and they live a curious lifestyle. Well, Alan Schildner responds, that's right. Even today, they basically live very much like they did 250 years ago. So the Amish don't use any modern conveniences. For example, their main mode of transportation is still the horse and buggy. They don't have any electricity in their homes, and they don't use any telephones. Swain asks, so in an interesting mix of genetics and environment, because they're getting the sort of incidental exercise that people like you preach about that the general public should have and doesn't get. And Schildner responds, that's right. They live in a very traditional lifestyle, and in particular with respect to farming. They're very physically active, and the other reason that they're in very good physical condition is that they tend to live a very homogenous lifestyle. Swain asks, well, now, with founder effects, traditionally, you do get curious incidents of certain diseases. I think in Quebec they experience unusual bone diseases. Well, what, if any, do the Amish get? And Schildner responds, well, the Amish do have a lot of inbreeding. So like other cultural isolates that are small, there are a number of autosomal recessive disorders that are typically very rare in the outbred population, but more common in the inbred Amish population. And Swain asks, and you've been studying type 1 diabetes. Do they get diabetes more often than others? Schildner, we study both type 1 and type 2 diabetes among the Amish in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. For type 2 diabetes, it's interesting. The Amish are just as obese as the general population because they also eat a lot. And yet they actually have less than one half the prevalence of type 2 diabetes compared to the general population. And what do you think the reason for that is? Swain asked. We believe the reason is that the Amish are very physically active, and it's been shown that high levels of physical activity can actually prevent the progression of type 2 diabetes in people who are genetically susceptible. So there's the answer, couch potatoes. It's your lifestyle. Now, as it relates to life expectancy, Swain asked, what's the Amish life expectancy? And he said their life expectancy is actually similar to the general U.S. population. Average life expectancy, 75. That's actually very interesting from a number of standpoints because, for one thing, they tend not to use modern medical care very much. The Amish avoid medical doctors. Swain asked, I was going to ask you that, is there a bias for or against medical care influencing life expectancy? Schindler responded, well, for the most part, the Amish don't like to use modern medical care. They will sometimes, if they have to, they will go to hospitals and will go to seek physicians, or at least some of them do, if they absolutely need to. But on the whole, they believe in prevention. They'll only go to a doctor if there's a problem. So tuck that one away in your heart, boys and girls. Now there's one last question here concerning genetics. And Schwain asked, well, from genetics, is there any clue to better ways to intervene in terms of type 2 diabetes? And Schildner responds, well, type 2 diabetes is an example of a complex disease in which there are many genes that are likely to be involved. We don't have our finger on all of them just yet. We hope over the next 5 or 10 years we will, and once we know what those genes are, I think we'll have, or that'll give us, a much better handle on what causes diabetes and specifically how to use that information to identify individuals who are susceptible to prevent it, as well as better modalities to individualize the therapy. So in essence, we have great expectations that genetics will bring us to that point, but at this point in time, we don't know the genes yet. Well, I underlined a number of terms in here, and then this concept of genes and genetic causes. Because if it's genetic, then you're not responsible for it. I mean, think about it for a minute. And if it's your mother and father and the genetic makeup of your body, I mean, it's like having blue eyes or blonde hair. You know, I've got blue eyes and blonde hair, but I didn't have anything to do with that. It's genetic. And an African American comes along and says, gosh, I've got black eyes and black hair, and I want to have blue eyes and blonde hair. And partner, you ain't never going to have blue eyes and blonde hair any more than I'm going to have black eyes and black hair. It's genetic. Is diabetes genetic? Well, now take a look at the Amish over here. The Amish have the same lifestyle that we have. The exception is they work hard. And because of the physical activity, they have less than half of the diabetes problems. Now, they probably don't drink as much soda pop. They probably don't eat as much sugar. Probably. I don't know that, but I'm just guesstimating because I've known a few of them. And because of that, they have less diabetes. Lifestyle, not genetics. Now, families that sit together at the dinner table eat the same foods. Mothers that give Coca-Cola to little children are drinking Coca-Cola themselves. And it's the Coca-Cola that is a lifestyle. It's a habit that you learn. I learned it from my daddy. He bought me a Coke sitting in the brass rail. He's sitting there drinking beer with his buddies and bought me a Coke. Didn't want to leave me out. I'm about 4 years old. And I thought Coca-Cola is the greatest thing since it's the nectar of the gods. You know, since sliced white bread, if anybody developed anything better than Coke, he kept it for himself. I'm not opposed to drinking a Coca-Cola, but two Cokes a day is too many. One Coke a month is probably about right. So I said in this series of programs, I'm going to tell you how much to drink. Coca-Cola is not good food to start with. It tastes good. It's a treat. You ought to have a treat once in a while. It's like Godiva chocolate. Ordinary people eat Hershey chocolate. I eat Godiva chocolate. Chocolate is not the best food. You don't find it in the government's food groups. Chocolate tastes real good. If you're going to eat chocolate, you should do so about once a month. Have two pieces of chocolate, and you might as well have a couple of good ones. So go into the Godiva shop and pay $6 each so that you're spending $12 on two pieces of chocolate. Take them home, eat them, savor them, suck on them a little bit, lick them, you know, breathe on them, and don't inhale them, you know, like a York peppermint patty. Just kind of savor it a little bit and do that about once a month, and I think you'll live to be 110. Now, if you're going to suck on that chocolate every day, day after day after day after day, and you're going to avoid eating broccoli and Brussels sprouts, I think that's going to pose some problems for you. Same thing with Coca-Cola. You ought to drink one Coke a month, whether you need it or not, just to show that you can do it without getting diabetes. But I said one a month. One a month. In fact, it would be good if you drank a third of it on one day, a third of it the next day, and a third of it the third day, one a month, so that your body can dispose of that 3 teaspoons and you don't overload your system. Because remember, it's got 9 teaspoons of sugar in your body. You can only dispose of 3 a day. And let me give you a reminder here, talking about diabetics and diabetes here. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about diabetes. Diabetes isn't a legal problem in the same way that AIDS is. AIDS isn't a medical problem, it's a legal problem. Diabetes is a medical problem more than it is a legal problem, although diabetes does involve the violation of law. You can't get sick without violating a law, but there's no specific law that tells you don't eat white sugar, but there is a specific law that tells you not to eat fat, and fat makes you obese. Now, here's a study that came out of England, which deals with this thing of fast foods cause Obesity. I'm going to dig around here through my file. Come on here, Georgie. Obesity and type 2 diabetes, 30-something diabetes. I already covered that. Yeah, here it is. Study says eating fast food makes you fat. I don't think that's true. I think eating too much fast food makes you fat. Now, Americans are spending 47% of their food dollar in fast food restaurants. Well, I say fast food restaurants, it's in restaurants, whether it's the Olive Garden or McDonald's. 47 cents, that's almost half. So in round numbers, we're spending about half to eat at home and about half to eat out. Now, the food that we eat out is food that is being sold to us. And I've noticed that they want to sell more to us. So you go to the Olive Garden and you sit down to eat. And when I was probably 30 years old, I could have ate the whole thing. But now, you know, I'm 65 or more, and I can't eat all that food. And I'm not as active as I used to be. You know, when I was a youngster, you know, I'd run up and down. I can remember one time I put a scaffold up on a four-story building, and I'd scamper up and down that scaffold at least once an hour, sometimes two or three times an hour. I had a rope up there, and I'd pull stuff up there, but it wasn't anything for me to, you know, just go over the side and scamper down to the bottom or run up to the top of it. Why, if I had to climb to the top of a four-story scaffold today, well, I'd be all tuckered out. That's the difference between 30 and 60. It's the difference between how much you can eat and how much you can't eat. Now, I can eat just about as much as I used to, but if I did, I'd be as big as a pig. I'd be big, like an old sow, you know, wallowing in mud. So I've got to cut back on the amount of food that I eat. Number one, I'm not as hungry. I don't eat as much. But even on top of that, I've got to cut back more and more, because as you get older and older, you should be eating less and less, because you're exercising less and less. Now, here's a lesson for you to learn. There's a direct correlation between fat and calories. And so people, they drink the diet pop because they want to watch their calories. Well, boys and girls, by the time you watch your vitamin E and your CoQ10 and your vitamin this and your vitamin that and your calories here and your calories there, I mean, you want to spend your whole life counting calories and watching vitamins, or do you want to live your life? I've got articles here, and they say, for this diet, we know we've done this and that and another thing, and your taxpayer dollars have done this study and that study, and we find this and we find that. You know, the bottom line is, if you don't eat fat, you won't get fat. I used to say, have you seen a fat Chinaman? Well, the answer today is yes. But I can remember 20, 30 years ago, a fat Chinaman was about as rare as a set of teeth and a chicken's mouth. They just didn't exist. And that's because the Orientals, they didn't eat very much in the way of fat. They didn't eat very much in the way of meat. Now, I'm going to talk to you a little about diet here as it relates to vegetarianism. You know, the vegetarians have a point. If you're going to eat meat with fat, you ought to give up meat. But if you could give up fat without giving up meat, then there's no point in being a vegetarian, because that's a doctrine of devils. You see that in 2 Timothy. No, it's in 1 Timothy 4. In fact, while I'm at it, I'll just read it to you. 1 Timothy chapter 4. So the vegetarians come along, and they, like I said, they've got a good point, because they're telling you that this fat causes you to get fat. Fat and obesity causes, or is associated with, diabetes. In chapter 4 it says, now the Spirit speaks expressly that in the latter times some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of devils. Now here are some of the doctrines of these devils. Speaking lies and hypocrisy. That's President Bush. Having their conscience seared with a hot iron. That's our military. Killing women and children in Iraq. Forbidding to marry. That's Catholic priests. And commanding to abstain from meats which God has created to be received with thanksgiving of them which believe and know the truth. That's vegetarians. I mean, come on, kids. I didn't write that, so don't get mad at me. But as a reporter, I need to report to you that eating meat isn't against the law. Eating the wrong kinds of meat is against the law. Because going on here, and here's where the Christians come in, they say, for every creature of God, now this is Paul speaking, he says, for every creature of God is good, and nothing to be refused if it be received with thanksgiving, because it's sanctified by the word of God in prayer. So you go into a restaurant, and you see some Baptist guy comes in with his family, they sit down and order ham and eggs, and then they all pray over it, and then they sit down and eat this pig. Now the scripture tells you plainly, here's Jesus. Now he said plainly in Matthew 4, verse 4, he said, man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. He said that in Matthew 4, 4. And he quoted that from Deuteronomy 8, verse 3. Man doesn't live by bread only, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. So let's flip over here and look at some more words of God in Leviticus chapter 11, which deals with clean and unclean meats. And let's see what God said about eating clean and unclean. Very simple. There's only three scriptures, clean and unclean meats. Leviticus 11, verse 3. Whatsoever parts the hoof and is cloven-footed and chews the cud among the beasts, that shall you eat. Vegetarians tell you, no, God made a mistake. He lied to you. That's bad. Don't eat meat. God says, now eat meat. eat meat from those animals that part the hoof, cloven hoof, and chew the cud. He went on a step further and he said, eat, or he says, don't eat swine, verse 7. And the swine, though he divides the hoof and be cloven footed, yet he chews not the cud, he's unclean to you. So pigs are unclean. So you Baptists ought not to be eating pigs, because you ought to live by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God, not just some of them. And 1 Timothy 4, which tells you, and we'll go back to 1 Timothy 4 here in a second, to eat those that are sanctified, the meats that are sanctified, the meats that are set aside, the meat that are set apart, are these clean and unclean meats, to be eaten with thanksgiving to those that know the truth. Well, if you knew the truth, you'd obey God and keep his commandments. That's what Jesus told you to do, remember that? Man doesn't live by bread only, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Every word. Leviticus 11 is some of those words. And Leviticus 11 doesn't contradict 1 Timothy 4, and 1 Timothy 4 does not contradict Leviticus 11. All scripture is given by inspiration of God, and it's profitable for doctrine, reproof, correction, and instruction in righteousness. Over here in verse, I'm still in Leviticus 11, in verse 9. These shall you eat of all that are in the waters. Whatsoever has fins and scales in the waters and the seas and in the rivers shall you eat. All those that have not fins and scales in the seas and in the rivers, don't eat them. What has fins and scales, children? Fish have fins and scales. Some fish have fins but no scales. Don't eat those. Some critters that swim in the water, like shrimp, clams, crabs, they don't have fins and they don't have scales. Don't eat them. Some critters in the water have scales, like turtles and alligators, but they don't have fins. Don't eat them. You don't have to be real smart to figure this out. It's a hell of a lot easier than trying to count calories and trying to figure out what vitamins and minerals I ought to be eating and what I ought to be avoiding. The third one over here is in verse 22. And as you're dealing with, even these of them you may eat, the locust after his kind, the bald locust after his kind, the cricket after his kind, and the grasshopper after his kind. But all other flying, creeping things which have 4 feet shall be an abomination unto you. So if you see a fly or a beetle or a bug or a cockroach, don't eat it. If you see a grasshopper or a cricket or a bald locust, then go ahead and eat it. Now, frankly, if you want my personal opinion, I'd rather eat a baked wharf rat than I would to eat a damn bug. So you're not going to see me eating very many grasshoppers or locusts. But I want to point out that they're clean, and that in a pinch, if you were starving to death and you needed food, and if I get hungry enough, I might eat a locust. But boy, I got to get real hungry. But try to avoid these unclean meats. Now, if you're going to eat clean meat, don't eat the fat. Now, here's our problem. You go to McDonald's, they serve you clean meat. Beef is clean. Beef is good. Then they mix the beef with 30% fat, cook it up, serve it to you, and that's poison. Because the scripture also says in Leviticus 3:17 and Leviticus 7:22-27, do not eat fat. So you got the vegetarian over here says, don't eat meat. Well, he's got a good point. If you're going to eat meat with the fat, you'd be better off not to eat meat at all. Now, here's a study from Great Britain says, eating fast food makes you fat. Now, a new study gives scientific clout to the conclusion many already see as obvious. Eating lots of fast food makes you fat and increases the chance of developing diabetes. A study published in the Lancet Medical Journal this week found those who frequently ate fast food gained 10 pounds more than those who did so less often and were more than twice as likely to develop an insulin disorder linked to diabetes. Fast food is commonly recognized to have very poor nutritional quality, said Dr. David Ludwig. He's the director of the obesity program at Children's Hospital in Boston and the senior author of the study. But there have been very few studies, essentially no long-term studies, that have documented the effects, or the effects rather, of this dietary pattern on the key chronic diseases of Western civilization, obesity, type 2 diabetes, and heart disease. Well, I don't know about that. I saw a tape here the other day, if you can get a copy of it. It's called Supersize Me. And a young man, I've forgotten his name now, young man, you know, a big strapping young fella, weighed about 180 pounds, lean and mean. He went on a McDonald's diet for 30 days. And before he went on the McDonald's diet, he went in and they took every kind of test. They took his blood test. They took his triglycerides. They took his this and they took his that. They took everything. And they added it all up and said, this guy's in perfect health. He doesn't wear glasses. And I don't know if he was a vegan or a vegetarian, but he wasn't a meat eater, as I recall. And he's in good health, and he's doing his thing, and he's living his life, and he decides that he wants to go on this McDonald's diet. So he did, and in 30 days, he came back, and he had every kind of bad number you could think of. I mean, his triglycerides were high, his cholesterol was high, his everything about the samples that they took. In fact, long before the 30 days was up, After 10, 15 days, there was three doctors supervising, three doctors, a nutritionist, and a physical therapist, a physical, you know, some guy, some gym guy, supervising this guy in this 30-day experiment. And all three doctors suggested that he give up the McDonald's diet because it was just raising hell with his health. And that's all he was eating was out of McDonald's. He didn't eat anywhere else. Drank the Coke, ate the Big Macs, he ate the fish, he ate. And then the objective was that he had to eat everything on the menu at least once in 30 days. He's eating there three times a day. So, yeah, a study has been done. And it was done for 30 days, and it was done under a doctor's supervision, three doctors. In fact, they kept track of this guy. I mean, he was in here every week for the entire 30 days, four times, and they were taking blood samples, and they were monitoring the deterioration of his health eating just at McDonald's. Okay. And in spite of that, I'm not opposed to McDonald's. I mean, hell, that's, you know, Coca-Cola, nothing wrong with drinking a Coke once in a while. But eating at McDonald's three meals a day for 30 days will kill you. Didn't kill this guy, but if he'd stayed on it, it would have killed him. And McDonald's doesn't want to kill you. They want to keep you alive, you know, so you can keep coming back and buying their Big Macs. Now, in the absence of such data, the fast food industry continues to claim that fast food can be part of a healthful diet. Ludwig's U.S.-based team followed 3,000 young people enrolled in a study of cardiac health over 15 years, giving them medical checkups and asking questions about their diet, physical activity, and other lifestyle factors. Well, even after the scientists used statistical techniques to cancel out the impact of the other factors, those who said that they visited fast food outlets twice a week or more gained 10 pounds more over the course of the study than those who ate fast food less than once a week. By the way, the supersize me doctors all said that you should not eat at McDonald's more than once a month. A couple of three of them said never, you know, dietitians, but they were all pretty much agreed that you should not eat at McDonald's more than one time a month. Now, that would be 12 times a year. The only thing that I ever bought at McDonald's was their coffee because it was hot, and then some woman got burned, and now when you go to McDonald's, they haven't even got hot coffee. So for me, there isn't any reason to go to McDonald's. There used to be one reason, hot coffee. Now I haven't even got hot coffee to go in for. Well, I guess there is one reason to go to McDonald's. They have clean restrooms. I mean, you could go in and go to the bathroom. But other than that, McDonald's is a loser. They also had more than double the chance of developing insulin resistance, considered a predictor of type 2 diabetes, the form of the disease linked to obesity. These findings suggest that fast food as presently consumed can really not be part of a healthful lifestyle. We underlined the words as presently consumed. Jesus said, no glutton shall enter into the kingdom of heaven. No drunkard shall enter into the kingdom of heaven. I think that's self-explanatory. He doesn't want fat pigs in there. He wasn't a fat pig, and he doesn't associate with those that are. Jesus drank booze. In fact, they accused him. They said, this guy is a wine bibber. They called Jesus a wino. Jesus drank wine. Can you believe that? And the Bible does not tell you not to drink booze. In fact, it tells you that you should drink strong drink, especially during the holidays. But it tells you that no drunkard shall enter into the kingdom of heaven. Religious people are teetotalers and say you should never drink. Drinking is bad. It's unchristian and it's bad for you. Drinking's not bad for you. It's excessive drinking that's bad for you. Now, I told you I couldn't handle credit cards. It isn't credit that's bad for you. It's excessive credit, and it's your inability to handle credit. And that's my big failing in life. I can't handle credit. So I don't have any. I don't use it. I don't have any credit cards. I avoid them like AIDS, herpes, and VD. And if you're an alcoholic, I would suggest that you avoid booze. You know, it's tough to kick the smoking habit. It's tough to kick booze. If you can't kick it, you know, you gotta get off of it and stay away from it, period. If you can't handle McDonald's, you know, once a month, you know, well, then you ought to kick the habit and don't go in there at all. Now, it tastes real good. I'm not telling you now that the fast foods don't taste good. Kentucky Fried Chicken's great stuff. I love it. My wife and I eat at Kentucky Fried Chicken about once a month. That's our fast food restaurant, KFC. And when I go to KFC, it's really a problem because I don't drink the soda pop. In the summertime, I don't like to drink hot coffee. And I don't like to drink their water because it's chlorinated. Probably got fluoride in it, too. So when I go in there, the one we visit over here, they've got a little bin, and you can buy bottled water. That's the lifesaver. So I can go in, and I can have my one piece of chicken from KFC. And I can have all the coleslaw and all the vegetables that they've got on the salad bar. And I can eat, you know, in moderation. And once in a while, I like to eat at the Olive Garden. They got a pretty good menu there. And other than that, I mean, you know, if you've got a kick on McDonald's or Wendy's or something like that, if you were to do that in moderation, you could probably get away with it. But every time you eat one of those hamburgers, you're in violation of Leviticus 3:17 and Leviticus 7:22 through 27 because it's got 30% fat. Now, is there something else on the menu that you could eat? Something else. And the French fries are cooked in fat. Now, boys and girls, if it's against the law to eat fat, do you think that it would be any more lawful for you to eat something cooked in the fat? I mean, you know, kids, you know, let's grow up and be adults, shall we? Potatoes are great, but not cooked in soot, not cooked in fat. My old granny, bless her heart, she was a wonderful cook. Everything she cooked just tasted great. And that's because everything she cooked was cooked with pig. And if my granny ever cooked anything that didn't have pig, and I'm including blackberry pie, her crusts were just as flaky and just as wonderful made with lard. Lard in the pie crust. If my granny ever cooked something that didn't have pig in it, it was by accident or because she'd run out. And that had to be because of World War II. I mean, when she bought bacon, she saved the grease off the bacon and used that to cook with. When she cooked a pot of beans, she had a ham hock in it. And I'm telling you, that woman could cook, and that woman's food really tasted good. I mean, it was good. Okay, I wouldn't eat from my granny today if you paid me money. She'd been dead many years now, but I'd have to disappoint old granny. I'd have to tell her, you know, granny, that food killed granddad, and my grandmother killed my grandfather with her good cooking. He died at age 61, just like I'm describing here. People that develop diabetes are going to die young. Your lifespan is going to be cut by 17 years, 25 years. If you're under 45 and develop diabetes, your lifespan is going to be cut by 25 years. I say that's a hell of a penalty to pay. Now, you got a 75-year lifespan. To cut your lifespan by 25 years is to cut your life by one-third. To cut your life by one-third because you can't give up Coca-Cola and fat. And if you can't give up Coca-Cola and fat, children, well, then I guess you got to get diabetes, and I guess you got to live 50 years instead of 75. But it seems like to me to be a frightful penalty to pay for a lifestyle change that is not impossible to make. And I demonstrated that already. Now, the study was done in Great Britain. They did a fairly middling good study. If you want a copy of the paperwork here, well, it's msnbc.msn.com. Study says eating fast food makes you fat. All right, I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. Let me remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website. It's at georgegordon.org. It's an easy one, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact discs. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course, talking about diabetes. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.